My guest at this time is Ali Reza Jafarzadeh. He is the deputy director of the Washington office of the National Council of Resistance of Iran. That's the Iranian parliament in exile. He's also the man who first warned the West about Iran's current nuclear ambitions, and he's the author of The Iran Threat. He joins me now to discuss the latest developments in the debate over a nuclear deal with the Iranians, potentially, including the role Congress may play in evaluating such a deal, and now Russia's sudden willingness to sell missile systems to Iran. And Ali, thank you very much for being with us.
Sure, thank you. Appreciate it.
The Senate seems poised to pass legislation that would give lawmakers the ability to pass judgment on whether Iran is actually complying with any nuclear deal that ever gets done. You are favorable to this legislation. Explain why you think this is a step forward.
I think it's a step forward for several reasons. First of all, you definitely want the role of Congress, because it was Congress since the beginning that understood the threat of the Iranian regime, the need to curb the threat of the Iranian regime, and pass all the necessary legislations that led to sanctions. And it was those sanctions that brought the Iran regime to the table. So you want to keep the Congress involved. Second, if it's not Congress getting involved, then the administration would be unilaterally in charge of the whole thing in dealing with Iran, and knowing the Iranian regime's track record and a history of cheating and their willingness to defy, you always want that additional leverage, and Congress can play that leverage. And third, the fact that it was a unanimous bipartisan consent in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, I mean, 19-0 vote is stunning. It shows bipartisanship. It shows resolve. And I think hopefully this will act as a signal to Tehran that Congress is going to stay on top of it. And I hope the administration would use this vote, even before it's signed into law, as a leverage, really, to force Tehran to accept, snap inspections with immediate access to military sites such as Parchin, Sepahan headquarters, and Lavizan 3, and also get satisfactory and full response to all of the outstanding possible military dimension questions, that is, the code word used by IAEA regarding weaponization, and also to end Tehran's research and development. So I see this as a very important step forward in the right direction.
The counter argument, as you may have heard, sir, is that this bill makes it much harder for Congress now to stop a deal, because if they do sense that the Iranians are cheating on any deal, it would probably take two-thirds of both houses to put the sanctions back in place or to keep them there, because the president most likely would not go along with the legislation. How concerned are you about that, if at all?
Well, that certainly is a concern, and I know there were some senators who wanted to introduce a language or an amendment to the bill, which is still possible, that would turn the agreement with Iran tantamount to a treaty that would require the president to produce the majority veto-proof support in the Senate to speak with. That is 67 votes in favor of that agreement, instead of now basically 34 votes to sustain a veto. So, that is certainly a concern. But I think what I saw yesterday, both among the Democrats and the Republicans, as we speak right now, in terms of the resolve and the focus of Congress, I think the president may actually have a difficult time to even get that 34 votes that he requires to sustain a veto. So let's see how things develop in the next few weeks.
And you testified before Congress on Tuesday as well. Sir, the Obama administration and the Iranians obviously have had two very different public versions of what is included in the framework that was agreed upon a couple of weeks ago. What are you hearing from your sources about what is really in the framework, and whether it would actually do any good in preventing Iran from getting a nuclear weapon?
Well, the two versions of the framework, which it was supposed to be just one version, even though it was oral agreement, are very different. The main differences relate to inspections and also the issue of the lifting of the sanctions, which are basically the two pillars of the negotiations. Tehran's version is that we're not going to allow you snap inspections. We're not going to allow you to inspect any sites in Iran. We're just going to basically allow you to the declared sites. Whereas the U.S. version is that the access has to be provided to all the suspect sites, and that, of course, includes the military sites, which has been off-limits so far. And knowing the fact that all of the key suspect sites have been in the military sites, that's the way Tehran has been using to hide its program. If the inspections are not extended to military sites, it becomes just totally irrelevant, and there would be, you know, it makes no sense. The second dispute is about the sanctions. Tehran version is that, you know, you lift all the sanctions at the time of the signing of the deal, which is before Tehran takes any steps to modify its program at all, whereas the White House version is that, no, all those sanctions are going to be lifted gradually after Tehran complied with its nuclear commitment. So there's sharp difference. And what made things even worse was that the Supreme Leader, Ali Khamenei, who has the final say on all things related to nuclear program of Iran, made a statement a few days ago saying that the sanctions have to be lifted, you know, immediately, not conditional upon any steps that Iran would take. And also he said, you know, the military sites are off limits. So I don't know what's going to happen at the end of the road, but I think the U.S. side, the 5+1 side, will have to stick with the agreement that was announced, even though many people believe even that agreement with all those provisions is still not enough, and it still leaves the door open for Iran to you know, drive its way to getting the bomb.
Can Iran be trusted at all?
Absolutely not. If you look at the whole history of this whole issue of the nuclear weapons program of Iran, over the past 30 years, Tehran started by cheating. Every single nuclear site of Iran have been exposed by the Iranian resistance, not by the Iranian regime. And Tehran has been caught cheating continuously and consistently over the past 10, 15 years when the inspections started in 2003, right after the revelation of the nuclear site in Natanz by the main opposition of Iran, the National Council of Resistance of Iran. So if you just look at the history in the past two, three decades, that will indicate that Tehran cannot be trusted. Look at the way they have handled the negotiations. They say one thing during the talks, and then when they get to Tehran, they say something else. And they can never be trusted, not just because of their nuclear behavior, but also in terms of their engagement in terrorism, the human rights violations in Iran, the killing their own citizens. Rouhani, who is supposed to be the more moderate version of the Iranian president, has killed more people under his watch than was killed under Ahmadinejad during the same period.
Really?
Yes. You know, Iran has the highest per capita executions in the world, and it's close to 1,400 people executed under Rouhani since he became president, which is a higher rate than it was under Ahmadinejad. There has been no opening up of the society. All the promises that Rouhani has made has not been materialized. Basically, all Rouhani has done in the past year and a half since he took office was basically negotiating on the nuclear issue, trying to get the sanctions lifted. That's all he's done. And in order to make up for the weaknesses of the regime and make sure that the population don't stand up and raise their voice, Tehran has increased the level of repression and the killing.
Wow. Last topic before we let you go, Ali, is we now see reports, of course, that Russia is willing to sell missile systems to Iran. Most reports suggest that it would be for defensive purposes, which would make any military action against Iran largely ineffective. But, of course, Russia has been aiding this Iranian nuclear program from the very beginning. So what do you make of this latest apparent cooperation?
Well, this is not good news, certainly, because, of course, the Russians have a horse in the race. They have been involved with the nuclear program of Iran since day one, the Bushehr nuclear reactor, but they also are looking for some economic benefits. Even with the framework agreement, which actually nothing has been signed, they have actually used that to go ahead and get into the Iranian market. They're trying to rush and get ahead of everybody else. And these missiles that they're providing is actually going to help boost the Iran regime's military, not for a good purpose. But also the other problem is that the more the Russians get invested in Iran, the more difficult it will become for them to vote against the Iran regime's violations in the future during the U.N. Security Council, because the chances are this issue, in case Tehran violates, which would definitely they will do, it will have to go back to the U.N. Security Council, and then, you know, you have the Russians there. So the more you get them involved, the more difficult it will become to get their cooperation in standing up against the Iran regime. So I see that certainly as a bad news.
Ali Reza, certainly some very sobering challenges that lie ahead. Thank you very much, sir, for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Good pleasure always to be on your show, Greg.
Ali Reza Jafarzadeh is the Deputy Director of the Washington Office of the National Council of Resistance of Iran. That's the Iranian Parliament in Exile. He's the man who first warned the West about Iran's current nuclear ambitions, and he is also the author of The Iran Threat. I'm Greg Corumbus, reporting for Radio America.